Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Dorothy Gundy, Katie Weaver, Anna Mateo, and Brian Lynn. Later, Katie Weaver and Ashley Thompson have a special report on one of America's national treasures. But first, this report. Cara Rowles enjoys hard work. The native of Tarpon Springs, Florida, learned to love being busy from her father. My dad always had a lot of different jobs at once, and so that's the model that I saw, she told VOA. My dad will often work a job all day and then go to another job at night. It wasn't a crazy concept for me. So when Rowles began studying at Bethune-Cookman University in Daytona Beach, Florida, in 2008, she was more than happy to support herself. Her parents gave her a little financial assistance, but she covered most of her education costs with loans and her own income. At first, Rowles worked part-time as a teacher for very young children. But she says the average pay for workers in that field in Florida is very low. So she took on other teaching positions to make more money. In 2010, she decided to change schools. She began studying theater performance at Florida Agricultural and Mechanical University in Tallahassee, also called Florida A&M. And she took on more jobs. She began teaching dance, as well as taking care of children.
But changing schools slowed her progress toward a degree. To speed it up, Rowles had to take more than 6 classes in one term. In addition, she was working between 10 and 45 hours each week at her jobs. Always being busy would often cause her to feel stress and miss sleep, Rowles says. And, she says, she was not able to enjoy many of the social experiences involved in American higher education. But Rowles was able to finish her study program as planned in 2012. She even earned a graduate degree from Florida State University in 2015 while working just as much as she had as an undergraduate. The most difficult part of her college experience, Rowles says, was learning that despite all her hard work, she still owed about $100,000 in student debt. She does not regret how much or how hard she worked, but she does feel her experience offers some valuable information about balancing work and studies that many college students could use. College students should know their worth, Rowles says, and they should avoid sacrificing other parts of their lives for work if they can.
The majority of students at colleges and universities in the United States work while they study. And the amount that students are working while studying is increasing. Also, the more hours college students work outside their studies, the more harm they may be doing to their academic success. In 2015, The Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce reported on the state of working college students. The center found that 70% of all U.S. college students have a job while they are enrolled in school. Many of these students are putting a lot of hours into their jobs. The center found that almost half of undergraduates work more than 30 hours per week. And one quarter of students study full-time while working full-time, at least 40 hours a week. Nicole Smith is the chief economist for the center. She says the numbers of students working and the numbers of hours they work have all increased over the past 30 years. One reason is that the cost of college in the U.S. has increased greatly in that time. However, that is not the only reason more college students are working more hours.
Smith notes that even students whose families can afford to support them are working while they study. That is because employers are expecting more and more out of college graduates, including work experience, she says. Employers are less likely to want to train their workers for the job traits that you would not necessarily learn within a college setting, she told VOA. Employers are expecting, by the time you walk in, that you can do exactly what they expect you to do, and you have all of the experience necessary so that you can be a 100% productive employee from day one. Smith admits that research shows working up to 15 hours a week can be helpful for college students. It can improve their time management skills, for example. But when students work more than that, they risk more than just missing out on social events, as in the case of Rowell's, she says. With students' attention split between work and class assignments, their performance in both areas will suffer. The ACT Center for Equity in Learning is an organization that studies education in the United States. In August 2017, it reported that working more than 15 hours a week can seriously limit college students' ability to complete their study programs. The ACT Center's research showed that working more than 15 hours affected both high and low-income students similarly. It reported that just 57% of high-income students who worked more than 15 hours weekly completed their study programs in 6 years. Only 41% of low-income students who worked more than 15 hours a week completed their programs in the same time. In comparison, college students from either income level who worked under 15 hours were nearly 20% more likely to finish in 6 years than those who worked more.
Professor Laura Perna suggests that a big part of the problem is that overworked college students do not have the time to seek help. Perna teaches in the University of Pennsylvania's Graduate School of Education. She is also the executive director of the Alliance for Higher Education and Democracy. Perna notes that there are only so many hours in the day. Students with jobs do not often have the time to make use of the support services schools offer, such as academic and financial advising. When those offices are only open a certain number of hours, she told VOA, students who are working may find it more difficult to access those really important services that they need in order to make timely progress to their degree. Perna and Smith agree that as older Americans increasingly seek higher education, working college students will become more common. These older students will likely not have parents' financial support and may even be supporting other people themselves. In addition, Perna and Smith point out first-generation and low-income students of any age are more likely to pay for their education by working. They often choose to do so rather than by taking out larger loans. As the student population changes, Perna and Smith say U.S. colleges and universities will need to consider how they advise their students and serve their changing needs. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Every year, as southern Arizona cooled, architect Frank Lloyd Wright and his students would travel there to escape the cold of winter in Wisconsin. Wright's students built shelters at a place he called Taliesin West, northeast of the state capital, Phoenix. They stayed there during the winter term of his School of Architecture. The buildings were wide open to nature. They had no electricity, running water, doors, or windows. The shelters are still used as housing today. From 1937 until 1959, when Wright died, Taliesin West was the winter home of America's most famous architect. The original Taliesin was Wright's home in southwestern Wisconsin, a central state. Taliesin is the name of a 6th century writer. It means shining brow. The buildings of Taliesin West are made of redwood beams and large rocks. They were covered early on in an almost transparent canvas to let in light. The canvas was later replaced with plastic, which is stronger against the desert sun. Windows were large openings without glass. The 198-hectare site in Scottsdale, near the McDowell Mountains, is still the winter home of the graduate school. Students can earn a Master of Architecture degree there. It is also the headquarters of the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation, which governs many of the architect's buildings. More than 100,000 people visit Taliesin West each year. It has been named a National Historic Landmark. Wright Foundation officials say the number of visitors has increased sharply because this year marks the 150th anniversary of Wright's birth. Visitors can see the room where Wright designed some of his most famous buildings, including the Guggenheim Museum in New York. Wright lived to see more than 500 of his designs built. They include homes, offices, and schools. Another very famous Wright work is Falling Water, a private home built over a waterfall in a Pennsylvania forest. Wright also designed the 19-story Price Tower in Bartlesville, Oklahoma. Florida Southern College in Lakeland, Florida, and the Ennis House, a home in Los Angeles designed like a Mayan temple. Experts say Taliesin West is among the best buildings Wright designed. At the home, visitors can see the same desert landscape that Wright and his students looked at from the room where they created. It is a view that Wright once called a look over the rim of the world. I'm Katie Weaver.
Now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. The United States is a big country with many, many roads. Many, if not most, Americans depend on motor vehicles to get from place to place.
It goes without saying that when talking or writing, Americans often use expressions with words from the world of automobiles. Now, let's examine a few common expressions that come from parts of a vehicle. First is the part of the car that protects the front and back of a vehicle, the bumper. The bumper is what suffers the most damage in a small accident. The front bumper extends on both sides to the fender, which protects the front wheels. If your car hits someone else's and causes a small amount of damage, we call it a fender bender.
But let's get back to the word bumper. American traffic reporters often use the term bumper to bumper when describing heavy traffic. It means that vehicles are moving very slowly and almost touching each other. Americans can use the term bumper to bumper as an adjective. If you are late for dinner because of traffic, you can tell your friends, "Sorry I'm late, but traffic was bumper to bumper." They will understand.
Another part of a vehicle, mainly found on small trucks and on some models of cars, is the tailgate. This is the gate or doorway that opens up in the back of the vehicle. If your car or truck has one, you can lower the tailgate and sit on it. This door on the back of larger passenger vehicles has led to something very American, the tailgate party. Tailgate parties usually take place in a parking area where one or more of these vehicles are stopped. Their tailgates are open with food or drinks available for the drivers and their passengers.
In the United States, tailgate parties are common at large sporting events or music shows. Now, many cars do not have tailgates. That's fine. If you spend time with friends and others in a large parking lot before a rock concert or a big game, you are still tailgating. So that form of tailgating is fun. But it is not fun when someone is tailgating your vehicle. A tailgater is someone who drives much too close to the back of your car. At best, this can be a pain, if not making you, the driver, really angry. But tailgating is also dangerous and the cause of many rear-end accidents.
There are other behaviors that can lead to a traffic accident. Let's take rubbernecking, for example. Rubbernecking is when drivers slow down on a road to look closely at a wreck or something else eye-catching as they are passing. Some drivers can stretch their neck far out of the window to see something like a serious crash. This is where we get the term. Drivers who rubberneck, however, can create their own accidents. First, they slow down, causing problems for other drivers and affecting the flow of traffic. But more importantly, they aren't looking at the road in front of them.
The first rule of driving should always be look where you are going. Another rule should be stay calm. The most dangerous kind of driving behavior is road rage. This is anger or violence towards other drivers. Road rage is such a big problem in some areas that local governments have laws that make some acts of road rage illegal.
The road hog is more of a pain than dangerous. To hog something means to take too much of something. So a road hog takes up too much of the road. The road hog sometimes drives in two lanes of traffic. Other times, they may not let other motorists pass them.
And that brings us to the end of our road and this episode of Words and Their Stories. Next time you take a drive, you'll be able to talk about your fellow drivers.
And with any hope, you won't run into any road rage. I'm Brian Lynn.
And I'm Anna Mateo.
This week on our National Parks Journey, we travel to America's mountainous Pacific Northwest. We are exploring Mount Rainier National Park in Washington State. The mountain in Washington rises more than 4,300 meters above sea level. It is one of America's most glacier-filled peaks. Snow covers the top of the mountain year-round. Its glacial meltwater forms six major rivers. The Native Americans who lived in the Northwest called the Great Mountain Tacoma. One tribe said it was a monster that would eat people. Other old stories among Native Americans said the mountain could produce great amounts of fire.
In 1792, British explorer George Vancouver became the first European to see the mountain. He named it after a Navy friend, Captain Peter Rainier. Today, the people who live in the northwestern city of Seattle simply call it the Mountain. Mount Rainier is almost 100 kilometers outside of Seattle, yet it can be seen from almost any place in the city. Mount Rainier is not just a mountain. It is a sleeping volcano. Steam and heat often rise from the very top of the mountain, causing some of the snow to melt. More than 25 thick glaciers cover part of the mountain. Mount Rainier has long been a popular place to visit. Many people go to enjoy the beautiful and peaceful forests that surround the mountain. Others try to climb to the top of the Great Mountain. Hazard Stevens and Philemon von Trump became the first people known to reach the top of Mount Rainier. They reached the top in August of 1870 after a 10-hour climb through the snow.
In 1890, a young school teacher became the first woman to reach the top of Mount Rainier. Her name was Fay Fuller. For many years after her successful climb, she wrote newspaper stories asking the federal government to make Mount Rainier a national park. Many people who visited the mountain also wanted its environment to be protected by the federal government. In March of 1899, President William McKinley signed a law that made Mount Rainier a national park. It was the fifth national park established in the United States. Today, about 10,000 people try to climb to the top of Mount Rainier every year. The mountain is extremely difficult to climb. The National Park Service says only about half of the climbers successfully reach the top. Snow and ice cover parts of the mountain year-round. Severe weather is possible at any time. Many people have died trying to climb Mount Rainier. Experienced mountain climbers often use it as a difficult test for people who want to climb extremely tall mountains around the world.
But you do not have to be an experienced mountain climber to enjoy Mount Rainier National Park. More than 1 million people visit the park each year. Many enjoy hiking along the hundreds of kilometers of paths. The paths lead through flat meadows filled with wildflowers and up through forests of large old trees. Other visitors drive around the park to experience its natural beauty. They often see black-tailed deer, elk, and mountain goats. The large park is almost 100,000 hectares. Many lakes, rivers, roads, hotels, and camping areas are within the park. Experts believe that Mount Rainier could become a much more active volcano sometime in the near future. They say the real problem is that they do not know exactly when that could happen.
Experts also agree that the great heat produced by a volcanic explosion would melt the rivers of ice that are part of the mountain. This melting could happen in a matter of minutes. The melting ice would then produce flowing rivers of mud and rock. That would put people who live in the southern part of Seattle and in the nearby city of Tacoma in danger. These experts carefully study the conditions at Mount Rainier. They hope to be able to warn people of any dangerous change. But for now, the Great Mountain provides a safe and enjoyable place to visit in America's beautiful Pacific Northwest. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Katie Weaver.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.